She wasn't just watching her neighbors, she was controlling them. From behind her peephole in apartment 9F, she seduced, blackmailed, and manipulated everyone around her like they were puppets on strings. But when her latest victims, an emotionally broken woman and a cocky neighbor, start falling for each other, the game spirals into chaos. Secrets surface, surveillance is exposed, and the hunter becomes the hunted. This is a dark, twisted descent into obsession, power, and betrayal, where control isn't power, it's a ticking time bomb. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you That Bitch in Apartment 9F. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Peephole Prophet. You ever realize how much power you have just by paying attention? I don't mean scrolling your feed or pretending to care during someone's sob story. I mean really paying attention, noticing things, timing, patterns, tone, posture, eye twitches. People give away their deepest secrets not with their words, but with the shit they think no one's seeing. And me, I see everything. From apartment 9F, I'm not just watching, I'm orchestrating. This building, Parkview Towers, is supposed to be some kind of upscale urban sanctuary. That's what the brochure said. Luxury meets community living in the heart of the city. What a fucking joke. The elevators break down every other week. There's mold creeping through the baseboards on every other floor. And if you're dumb enough to leave your packages in the hallway, they vanish faster than dignity in a divorce. But here's the truth no one will tell you. Parkview Towers is perfect. Not because it's clean, not because it's safe, but because it's messy, flawed, cracked, just like the people inside. These walls bleed stories, and I've carved myself a front row seat to every act. I live alone in 9F. No pets, no plants, no live, laugh, love bullshit on the walls. Just me, my thoughts, and an arsenal of surveillance. One high-end peephole camera disguised as a hallway thermostat. A tiny mic embedded in the smoke detector. A mirror angled just right across from my living room window. Oh, and binoculars. Can't forget the binoculars. Cliche? Maybe. Effective? Absolutely. I started watching out of boredom. Now I can't stop. There's something godlike about knowing more than everyone else. About seeing how the pieces move before they even realize they're on the board. This isn't about curiosity, it's about control. And once you get a taste of that power, it wraps around your throat like a velvet leash. Tight. Addictive. Let's start with the basics. Apartment 9D, Mr. Thompson. Retired. Widower. Watches 80s porn on a loop and jerks off to it like it's still revolutionary. Keeps his curtains half open, probably because he thinks no one gives a shit about a lonely old man getting off in his recliner. He's wrong. I time his sessions. 2 minutes, 20 seconds on average. Last week he hit 4 minutes. I almost clapped. 9B, Abby. Early 30s. Hair always tied back in a messy bun, like she's trying to pretend she doesn't care, but her roots are always freshly dyed. She walks like her body's made of apology. Her boyfriend, Jason, a walking steroid with a caveman's vocabulary, comes over on Fridays, fucks her like she's disposable, and leaves by midnight. She cries herself to sleep after every visit. I record the audio. Not for blackmail. Just for documentation. I like to keep records. 9E Nate. The distraction. The temptation. The motherfucking problem. Nate is tall, carved from arrogance, and walks like he owns more than his credit score says he does. He leaves his blinds cracked just enough for me to see his routine. Morning stretches shirtless, evening showers with the door open. Sometimes he walks out of the bathroom completely naked, towel in hand, drying his hair like his dick isn't bouncing with every step. I should be disgusted. I'm not. I should respect his privacy. I definitely don't. I stare. I memorize. I fantasize. But more than that, I analyze. Nate likes being watched. That's the thing. He plays it off like it's carelessness, but no one keeps their lights on while undressing unless they want to be seen. And the more I watched him, the more I realized he wasn't just bait. He was game. I waited a month before making my move. I don't rush. I don't stumble into opportunities. I engineer them. Tuesday, 2:34 a.m. I wrote a simple note, folded it in half. Clean. No handwriting. Just typed in 12-point times New Roman like a true psychopath. You should really close your blinds. Someone might be watching. I slipped it under his door and stood in the hallway for a second, barefoot, heartbeat punching against my ribs. I didn't knock. I didn't breathe. I just let the silence hang like a noose. And then, I heard footsteps. Slow. Measured. Controlled. He paused in front of my door. I could feel him. Could hear the static of his breath on the other side of the wood. But he didn't knock. He walked away. And that night, he left his blinds open wider. Game on. By Thursday, he was fucking me. No names. No pleasantries. Just heat, sweat, friction, and teeth. He pressed me against his fridge like he was trying to brand me into the stainless steel. His fingers left bruises on my hips. My nails carved trails down his back like I was signing a contract in skin. I came harder than I expected. And when I left, hair tangled, thighs sore, lips swollen, I knew I'd won. But Nate wasn't the only target. See, while most people spend their lives trying to get others to like them, I spend mine collecting leverage. Some people hoard money. Others hoard love. I hoard secrets. And Kevin in 9C? That motherfucker is full of them. He's quiet. Polite. The kind of guy who apologizes when you bump into him. Always has groceries delivered. Always wears socks with sandals. Screams harmless from every pore. But I know the truth. He cheats on his taxes. Has a folder on his laptop labeled work receipts. But it's actually filled with downloaded BDSM porn and emails from some dominatrix named Madame Echo. The guy spends $500 a week on humiliation sessions and deletes his browser history like a nervous virgin. And now I have copies of every file. I didn't even have to break in. Just flirted with him in the laundry room once, mentioned I was a tech consultant. And he let me borrow his laptop while he went upstairs to grab detergent. 5 minutes was all I needed. Keylogger installed. Password's mine. Full control. I haven't used anything on him yet. Why would I? It's better to let them dig their own graves while I hold the map. Control isn't just knowing what people fear, it's knowing when to strike. That brings me back to Abby. Sweet, pathetic Abby. She's the kind of woman who buys emotional support candles and thinks horoscopes are divine instruction. She's fragile. Ripe. A human-shaped bruise. I caught her in the lobby one night, mascara running, lip trembling. Jason had left again. Slammed the door so hard the hallway lights flickered. You okay? I asked, all concern and innocence. She broke. Just like that. Now we do wine nights. Cry sessions. She spills her soul, and I hold the bucket. She doesn't know yet, but I'm going to save her. Not because I care, but because broken girls make loyal soldiers once you fix them just right. Soon, she'll think I'm her best friend. She'll tell me things she won't even admit to herself. And when the time comes, I'll show her what it feels like to matter, in exchange for total blind obedience. Because that's what I do. I don't just watch. I don't just listen. I invade. I infect. I rearrange the lives of the people around me until they orbit me like I'm their fucking sun. This building is mine. Every whispered lie. Every fucked up night. Every door that opens and closes like a chapter in a book I'm already rewriting. From apartment 9F, I don't live among neighbors. I reign over puppets. And trust me, I always pull the strings. Chapter 2, The Softest Spots to Stab. Nate fucked like a man with something to prove. He wasn't gentle. He wasn't sweet. He wasn't even particularly romantic. But what he lacked in tenderness, he made up for in aggression. The way his hands roamed like they owned my body, the way he held my neck like he was asking a question he didn't want answered, I let him think he was in control. Let him believe the moans tumbling from my mouth were because of him. They weren't. They were because I had him. Fully. Utterly. Obsessively. See, I didn't come back for seconds because of how good the sex was. I came back because of the way he looked at me afterward, confused, hungry, vulnerable. Like he knew something was off, but couldn't quite name it. That space between climax and clarity, when men forget how to lie to themselves, that's where I live. That's where I thrive. Nate thought we were fucking. What we were really doing was bonding. And not in the way normal people bond. We were chemically stitching trauma to lust, obsession to vulnerability. Every time I bit his shoulder or whispered into his ear, I was reinforcing his dependence. It's not about attraction. It's about wiring. You can't fake chemistry, but you can engineer addiction. The next morning, I didn't leave right away. I laid in his bed, tracing invisible symbols into his chest as he snored lightly. His body was heavy with sleep, but mine was electric. Awake. Calculating. His apartment was cleaner than I expected. Sleek countertops, designer soap, leather-bound books with uncreased spines, decor that screamed borrowed sophistication. A man who wanted to look smart more than he wanted to be smart. There was a half-finished whiskey on the nightstand, and his phone lit up every 10 minutes with messages from a girl saved as Val. I opened the latest one. "So I guess you're just ghosting now." Then another. "Fuck you, Nate. Lose my number." I smiled. The cracks were already forming. I got dressed slowly, deliberately. Left a single hair on his pillow. Swiped my finger across his bathroom mirror, just enough to leave a smudge. Small things. Invisible to the average eye. But I don't need obvious. I just need a trail. A whisper. A question that doesn't have an answer. Later that day, I bumped into Abby in the laundry room. She looked worse than usual, eyes puffy, hoodie zipped to her chin, mismatched socks like she got dressed in the dark. She was clutching her detergent bottle like it was a life raft. "Jason?" I asked casually. Her shoulders dropped. "He's gone." I tilted my head. "Like gone gone? Or see you next Friday gone?" She hesitated. "He said he needed space." Translation: he found someone new to hurt. I could have rolled my eyes, but I didn't. I nodded, bit my lip sympathetically, and offered the kind of fake warmth I've spent years perfecting. "You want to come by later? I've got wine and no plans." Abby's face lit up like someone had finally noticed her existence. "Really? Yeah, I mean, that would be nice." Hook, line, and future accomplice. Later that night, she sat on my couch wrapped in a fleece blanket, clutching a glass of red like it was a goddamn security blanket. We talked. Or rather, she talked. I just listened. And fuck, did she pour it all out. Jason's cheating. Jason's anger. Jason's accusations. Jason's refusal to delete nudes of his exes. The time he broke her phone and then gaslit her into thinking she dropped it. How he used to love her. How she still believed deep down that maybe he did. I didn't interrupt. I just took mental notes. Abby wasn't just hurt. She was programmed, like most abused women, to believe her worth was tied to whether or not a man stayed. And now that Jason was gone, she was floating. Directionless. People like her don't need friends. They need gods. And I had just descended from the heavens of 9F to become her personal savior. "You deserve better," I whispered, touching her knee gently. She looked at me with teary gratitude, like I'd just handed her the moon. And maybe I had. In her world, kindness was currency, and I was rich with it. She finished two more glasses. By the third, she was slurring. "He said I make him angry. Like, make him angry. Like it's my fault." She trailed off, curling into herself like a dying animal. I pulled the blanket tighter around her and let her cry. Not out of empathy, but because this was the breaking point. And once she broke, I could rebuild her into whatever I needed. Loyal. Grateful. Useful. After she passed out on my couch, I tucked her in. Not out of love, but out of strategy. Empathy is the sharpest knife in my drawer. While she slept, I slipped into Kevin's apartment. "I know what you're thinking. How?" "Easy. A copy of his spare key sits in my silverware drawer, right between the butter knives and the wine opener. He gave it to me himself, remember? Laundry room flirtation. In case of emergency, blah blah blah. Men like Kevin are starved for connection. You smile at them for 5 minutes, and they'll hand you their entire life." His apartment smelled like vanilla and shame. I moved quickly. I opened his laptop. Password still the same. Snoopy 1979. Jesus fucking Christ. The dominatrix emails had gotten juicier. Madame Echo had started requesting photos. Nothing face forward, of course. Just enough to verify identity. I copied them to a private drive. Next to the financial records, webcam session screenshots, and three emails he'd drafted to his wife but never sent. Then I found something new, something interesting. A hidden folder labeled Echo Refunds. Turns out, Kevin had recently disputed 4 charges from Madame Echo with his credit card company, claiming fraud. So while he was getting whipped and humiliated every Thursday night, he was secretly trying to claw his money back. And if Madame Echo ever found out, "Oh, Kevin, you delightful little liability." I grinned in the blue glow of the screen, the rush of discovery washing over me like good sex. By the time I slipped back into my own apartment, Abby was still snoring softly. I stood over her for a long minute, watching the rise and fall of her chest, listening to the pathetic sighs escaping her lips. She looked so peaceful. So moldable. You see, the thing about people is they're like wet clay. They don't realize how easy they are to reshape until you stick your fingers in. And me, I've got dirt under every nail. So by the end of that day, here's what I had. Nate, physically addicted and emotionally confused. One well-timed moan away from giving me access to his entire life. Abby, broken, dependent, and one more glass of wine away from thinking I was the only person who truly understood her. Kevin, sitting on a ticking time bomb of lies, ready to explode with one spark from Madame Echo or me. And me, I was goddamn thriving. But here's the thing about puppets, they don't dance without strings. And next week, I was going to start pulling. Chapter 3, Rotten Roots Don't Grow Roses. I've learned that trust doesn't grow, it's carved. Etched into the space between desperation and dependency, molded by silence, shaped by guilt. It's not something people give freely. Not really. They hand it over when they're weak. When they're tired. When they've been hollowed out and someone, me, steps in to fill the void. By the end of the week, I had two types of people in my life. Those who wanted me, and those who needed me. Nate, Kevin, and Abby, my little dysfunctional holy trinity. Each gripping a different part of the rope I was slowly wrapping around their throats. All it would take now was a tug. Thursday morning started like most others. Coffee with two sugars, black nail polish chipped from digging into Nate's back the night before, and an inbox full of evidence. Kevin's keystrokes had been especially generous overnight. He'd tried to delete the Madame Echo folder. Poor baby thought if he dragged it to the trash and hit delete, it would disappear forever. But he forgot I installed sync access. Every file he thought was gone, still sitting in my cloud, waiting, breathing. I poured my coffee, took a long sip, and started typing. Subject Q. Me. This afternoon. Roof. 3 p.m. Don't be late, Kevin. We need to talk about. Echo. 9F. I didn't sign my name. He'd know. My presence was already seared into the back of his mind, like a cigarette burn. He was probably sweating the moment he saw it. Good. Let him squirm. I turned back to Abby. She was still in my bed, tangled in my sheets like some tragic thrift store Venus. Her mascara from last night had smeared like war paint, her breath soft, her shoulders twitching with whatever nightmare she was dancing through. I didn't wake her. Instead, I quietly unlocked my phone and opened the voice recording from the night before. I mean, sometimes I think I'm the problem. Maybe if I was thinner. Or if I didn't text him so much. Or if I just shut the fuck up when he's angry. That soft, broken voice echoed in my ears as I stood in my kitchen, eyes fixed on the skyline. She had no idea she was being recorded. Even better, she had no idea what I planned to do with it. By 3 p.m., I was on the rooftop of Parkview Towers. The view was decent, rusted railings, concrete slabs, and cigarette butts nestled between bird shit and dreams. The city stretched out in every direction like it was daring you to jump. Kevin arrived on time. He always did. That's the thing about weak men, they confuse punctuality with morality. He approached with his usual limp-spined gait, shoulders slightly hunched, laptop bag over one shoulder like a high school virgin on his first day of college. Hi, he said. Voice quiet. Nervous. Sit, I said, pointing to the ledge. He sat. Right on command. Good boy. I know. I began, sipping my iced latte like this wasn't about to shift the tectonic plates of his pathetic life. You've been naughty. Kevin blinked, confused. I what? Echo, I said slowly. The photos. The sessions. The money you begged for back after she paddled your ego raw. His face turned ghost white, then blotchy red. A storm of shame rolled across it like a tidal wave crashing against a sandcastle. Aye, how did? You gave me your laptop, Kevin. Remember? Laundry room? The day you complimented my necklace that wasn't even there. He looked like he wanted to die. His knees bounced. His fingers twisted around the strap of his bag like a rosary. I'm not here to shame you, I said, smiling. I'm here to protect you. That confused him. Good. Confusion is the gateway drug to manipulation. I want a favor. That's all. His eyes narrowed slightly, curiosity wrestling with panic. I need access to the maintenance closet, I said. You know the one next to the stairwell on 9? The one that holds the elevator panel and the surveillance hub. He blinked again. Why? I leaned closer, letting my words drip like honey laced with poison. Because I'm cleaning up this building, and I need eyes everywhere. If you help me, I'll make sure no one ever sees those little leather-stained selfies you've got hidden in your digital graveyard. Kevin swallowed hard. Okay, just like that. Power. People like Kevin are eager to follow, once you show them the monster living under their skin. Later that night, I watched Abby stare at her reflection for 27 straight minutes. She stood in my bathroom, a glass of wine in one hand, her phone in the other, scrolling through old pictures of her and Jason. Each scroll was slower than the last. She looked at her old smile like it belonged to a stranger. I knocked lightly. Everything okay? She didn't answer. So I stepped inside and gently took the phone from her hand. The picture on the screen was a selfie of her in bed, Jason asleep behind her, arm draped over her like a chain. "Delete it," I said. She flinched. "I can't." "You can," I said, my voice calm, firm. "And you will." She stared at me for a second too long, and then tapped the screen. "Delete. Gone." "That's the first step," I whispered. She nodded barely. Tears shimmered in her eyes, but didn't fall. "Now," I said, wrapping my arms around her waist from behind, staring into the mirror with her. "Let's make new memories." Her breath hitched. That night we kissed. Soft, hesitant, electrified by the unspoken hunger of two women who had both been used in different ways. Her lips were sweeter than I expected. Hesitant. Grateful. She slept in my bed again. And this time, I didn't stay on the couch. The next morning, Nate texted. "Wanna come over later?" I let him wait. Then I answered with a single word. "Maybe." Let him wonder. Let him ache. I stopped by Kevin's apartment that afternoon. He handed me a maintenance access fob without a word. I kissed his cheek in return, let my lips linger just long enough to confuse him. And in the elevator ride back to 9, I whispered to myself. Control isn't taken. It's earned. One weakness at a time. At 11:48 p.m., I crept into the maintenance closet. The cameras were easy. A few wires, a new feed routed to my system. Now I had eyes. Full access to the lobby, the stairwells, even the laundry room. Every hallway on every floor. Real-time surveillance. And the elevator panel? With a quick rewire, I gave myself override control. Now I could stop any elevator mid-floor. Trap people. Confuse them. Interrupt schedules. Sabotage timing. A little chaos goes a long way. You'd be surprised how fast lives unravel when routines shift. By the end of the week, here's what I had. Abby, emotionally bonded, mentally rewiring herself around my praise, beginning to crave it. Kevin, ensnared in blackmail, compromised and obedient. Nate, still reaching. Still unsure whether I'm his salvation or his downfall. And now I had access to their movements, their faces, their habits. I didn't just own their secrets anymore. I owned their reality. This building wasn't just full of neighbors. It was full of stories I was writing in real time. And every story had one thing in common. They all ended with me. Chapter 4. Surrender is a slow dance. People think power is about force. Slamming your fist on the table, raising your voice, pushing someone against a wall until they whimper or nod. That's rookie shit. Power isn't loud, it's quiet. Subtle. A whisper you don't notice until it's already in your bloodstream, numbing your spine, controlling your next move. Real power is the gentle hand that guides your chin until you look exactly where I want you to. And right now, everyone was starting to look exactly where I needed them to. I woke up to Abby breathing beside me, her arm draped over my stomach like a child clinging to their blanket. Her hair fanned across the pillow, her lashes twitching from the dream she didn't know I'd never let her wake up from. She'd fallen into me with the ease of someone who's always wanted to be wanted. And I made sure she felt safe in my arms. Warm. Held. Like I was her anchor in the storm that was her life. But deep down, I wasn't her shelter. I was the fucking hurricane. She mumbled my name as she stirred. It was soft. Unsure. Almost reverent. I kissed her forehead and untangled myself, slipping out of bed like a ghost. She didn't follow. Good. That meant the spell was holding. In the kitchen, I checked the feed. All the new camera angles, stairwells, lobby, laundry room, hallway 7A. The footage was perfect. High res. Clean audio. The building was now mine in more ways than the lease agreement said. I watched Kevin leave for work at 7:42 a.m. sharp, bag clutched to his chest like it was filled with secrets and shame. I watched Nate pace his living room shirtless, checking his phone, opening and closing the fridge like it might give him a purpose. I watched Abby's boyfriend, X, Jason, come into the building and leave 3 minutes later when no one answered 9B. I saw it all, knew it all, and more importantly, I could control it all. Later that afternoon, I texted Nate. "Feeling lonely yet?" He answered in 13 seconds. "You free tonight?" I let 3 hours pass. Then, "Maybe. What are you offering?" He responded with a photo. A bottle of wine. Two glasses. A smirk. Basic. Predictable. But useful. By 9 p.m., I was in his apartment again. I wore a black slip dress, no bra, no underwear. His eyes devoured me. I saw his throat tighten when I crossed the threshold. He tried to pull me into a kiss, but I pressed a finger to his lips. No touching yet. His body tensed like he'd been zapped. I walked past him slowly, swaying. Every step was deliberate. I let the silence hang between us like a hot breath. You like games, don't you, Nate? He nodded. Too quickly. I turned and smiled, but it didn't reach my eyes. You're not in control here. He looked confused, then annoyed, then turned on. That last one. That's the one I wanted. I fucked you, I said, standing over him now, his back pressed against the edge of his couch. And now you think I'm yours? He opened his mouth. Don't speak. He shut it. Good boy. I leaned in, lips grazing his ear. You're not the hunter here, Nate. You're the prey. You were from the second you left your blinds open. He swallowed. I took his wine glass from his hand and placed it on the floor. Then I kissed him. Hard. Aggressive. Teeth clashing. Tongues fighting. And when I pulled away, he looked dazed. Dizzy. That's when I whispered it. I could ruin you. He blinked, lips parted. And I knew I had him. Not just physically. Mentally. Emotionally. Spiritually. Nate wanted me not because of how I looked, but because I made him feel something. Danger. Uncertainty. The crackle of control slipping through his fingers. He craved it now. He'd chase it even as it destroyed him. And that's what made him useful. When I got back to 9F, Abby was sitting on the couch, blanket wrapped around her shoulders, glass of wine half finished on the table. She didn't ask where I'd been. That was new. She just looked up and said, I missed you. That simple. Three words that told me everything I needed to know. She was fully tethered to me now. No more questions. No jealousy. No accusations. Just longing. Longing disguised as patience. She reached for my hand, and I let her hold it. We watched some documentary on cults. Irony? Maybe. I call it foreshadowing. At one point, she rested her head on my thigh, eyes heavy. Why do you help me? She asked softly. I stroked her hair. Because no one else ever did. That answer was vague enough to be honest and manipulative at the same time. She didn't push for more. She just nodded, satisfied. She'd started folding my laundry, cleaning my dishes, texting me midday just to check in, all without me ever asking. See, loyalty born from affection fades. But loyalty born from salvation? That shit lasts forever. At 2 a.m., while she was asleep, I went downstairs. The hallway was silent. Dim. I slipped into the storage unit I had quietly claimed two floors below. Inside, a laptop, a backup drive, a corkboard, pins, strings, photos, schedules, maps. This wasn't just surveillance anymore. This was strategy. Abby's entire trauma history, from social media posts to an old blog she deleted in 2015, printed and annotated. Nate's financial records, court settlements, old dating profiles, his entire emotional blueprint. Kevin's deviance timeline, credit card transactions, fear points. Each of them mapped out like game pieces. I wasn't just playing with their lives, I was architecting their futures. And now I was ready to start phase two. I took out a blank note card, wrote in bold red ink, 9B plus 9E collision required. Abby and Nate had never officially met, but soon they would. And when they did, I'd be the one threading the needle, sowing chaos between them stitch by stitch. Why? Because sometimes to keep someone dependent on you, you have to break them again, just to be the one who picks up the pieces. Back upstairs, I stood over Abby, watched her sleep. Her breathing was soft, rhythmic. She looked peaceful, but she wasn't. She was drowning, and she didn't even know it. I kissed her temple and whispered, "You belong to me now." And deep down, some part of her already knew that was true. By morning, I was already setting up the next move. A chance meeting in the laundry room between Abby and Nate. A text from me to each of them. To Nate. Ever wonder what your type looks like when it's real? To Abby. Go switch your laundry in 10 minutes. You'll see. And me? I'd be watching from the feed. Sipping tea. Smiling. Because I don't just pull strings. I tie knots. I wrap them around necks. And I wait for the moment people realize they're already choking. Chapter 5, The Collision. Every good manipulation starts with a setup. Not just the obvious kind, the lie, the trap, the distraction, but the kind that's invisible until it's already destroyed you. The kind that makes you believe you're the one in control. That's what I did to Nate. That's what I was doing to Abby. And now, it was time to make them collide. It started with two texts, timed 7 minutes apart. Just enough space to let fate feel accidental. To Abby, don't forget to switch your laundry in 10 minutes. I'll be waiting for you when you get back. X. To Nate. Laundry room. Now, there's something I want you to see. No context. No fluff. Just enough command to make them follow, enough curiosity to make them ignore how creepy it was. I knew them both well enough now. Abby was already teetering, willing to do whatever I said just to feel safe, seen, relevant. And Nate, he was chasing a thrill he didn't understand, still convincing himself he was playing the game, even as I moved him like a pawn toward the center of the board. I watched everything unfold from my laptop. The Parkview Towers laundry room is a cold, tiled tomb with two vending machines for washers that constantly leak, and a flickering light that makes you feel like you're in the opening scene of a murder documentary. Perfect for tension. Perfect for sparks. Abby stepped in first. Hair wet. Hoodie zipped. No makeup. Her soft, anxious energy trailing behind her like a scent. She had headphones around her neck, but the music wasn't playing. She kept looking over her shoulder, like she could sense something was coming. She opened the dryer, started pulling out her clothes. Enter Nate. He walked in like he was the reason gravity existed. Black tee, sweatpants that hung just low enough to make your eyes stall, and that smug little smirk he wore like armor. He paused the moment he saw her. Abby didn't look up right away. I watched the tension stretch in real time like elastic. You could feel the awkward air between them. Then she glanced over. He nodded, did that half-smile guys do when they think they're charming. Abby forced a smile back. My heart skipped. Here we go. Hey, Nate said, moving toward the washer closest to hers. Abby tucked her hair behind her ear. Nervous tick. Hi, she replied softly. I muted the audio. I didn't need to hear the words to understand the energy. I was fluent in body language. I'd studied every twitch, glance, shift. They were doing the classic strangers in a confined space dance. Polite small talk, casual glances that lasted half a second too long, the beginnings of curiosity curling at the corners of their mouths. She reached into her basket and dropped a pair of panties. He bent down to grab them for her. Their fingers touched. I leaned back in my chair and smiled. Perfect. Abby blushed. Nate chuckled. He held the panties like he didn't want to give them back too quickly. I didn't need to push anything more today. That was enough. A seed was planted. Curiosity was born. They'd go back to their units thinking about it, replaying it, rewriting it. She'd wonder if he was into her. He'd wonder what her story was. And I'd feed both of them breadcrumbs until they met again, on my terms. That's the thing about proximity and tension. You don't need an explosion, just a flicker of heat in the right direction. Later that night, Abby returned to my apartment. She didn't mention Nate right away, but I saw it in her face. The glow, the distraction, the way she bit her lip every time she wasn't speaking. Her eyes danced somewhere behind her thoughts. What's going on up there? I asked playfully, tapping her forehead. She smiled, blushed. Nothing. Lie. She shifted in her seat, legs crossed and uncrossed, fingers playing with the hem of her oversized shirt. She poured herself another glass of wine. Still didn't say it, so I said it for her. Nate's hot, isn't he? Her head snapped toward me. What? I laughed. I saw the way you looked at him. Abby blushed, embarrassed. It was just the laundry room. Oh, come on, girl. He's hot. You noticed. I mean, maybe a little, she said, hiding behind her glass. Bingo. I wouldn't mind if you went for him, I added casually. Her eyes widened. Really? You're not? What? Jealous? I scoffed. Please. I'm not like that. Do you, babe? You deserve someone who looks at you like you matter. Her face softened. Her shoulders relaxed. She reached for my hand across the couch. You're amazing, she said. No, Abby. I'm everything. Meanwhile, Nate was blowing up my phone. What was that? Who was she? You set that up, didn't you? Are you watching me? Why does it feel so good when you control me? I didn't reply. Not for hours. Then finally, she's your type. You'll see. He didn't respond to that. Didn't need to. I knew he was hooked. Confused. Aroused. Threatened. Excited. People underestimate the power of tension between strangers. But tension creates friction. Friction creates heat. And heat is the first step toward devotion. The next day, I walked Abby past 9E. She didn't say anything, but her eyes flicked to the door. Just once. That's all I needed. I left a note for Nate under his door. Invite her for coffee. See what happens. I gave him no name, no confirmation, but I knew he'd know who I meant. He always follows when I lead. That night, Abby was in my shower, humming some sad indie song with broken lyrics and hopeful chords. I stood at my laptop, reviewing the hallway camera footage, watching Nate slide a note under 9B's door. When she returned to the living room, wrapped in a towel, skin still wet, eyes soft and sleepy, I smiled at her like I didn't just orchestrate her next obsession. She curled into me on the couch, trusting blind. "I'm so lucky I met you," she whispered. I kissed her shoulder and held her tighter. "No, Abby. You're fucked. You just don't know it yet. The thing about being a puppet master is that you can't fall in love with the marionettes. You have to keep your strings taut, your emotions cold, your vision sharp. But lately, something was slipping. There were moments, fleeting, dangerous moments, where I caught myself wondering, what if someone pulled my strings? What if I was being watched? I shook it off. Paranoia is the price of control. I chose this. Still, I checked the peephole twice that night. I locked the windows. I changed my laptop password. Not because I was scared, but because I had so much to lose now. Because I had a kingdom. And every queen knows. Sooner or later, someone comes for the crown. Chapter 6, Cracks in the Glass. You know you've really got someone when they start trying to keep secrets from you. Because that's when they start lying. That's when they start stumbling, overcompensating, hiding things that you already know. But letting you see them try to hide it? That's the delicious part. That's when the real manipulation begins. Because then they're not just lying to protect themselves. They're lying to protect the version of themselves you let them become. It started 3 days after the chance encounter in the laundry room. Abby had been quieter. Not cold, just distracted. She still curled into me at night. Still laughed at the dumb shows I put on. Still poured wine like we were in some soft-focus lesbian fairy tale. But something was different. I saw it in the way her fingers danced across her phone screen a little more often. The way she checked her hair in reflective surfaces. The way her eyes flicked toward her door whenever we passed 9E. I knew she hadn't told me yet. But Nate had. The coward couldn't even wait 24 hours before he cracked. She came over. I made her coffee. That's all. That's what he texted. Then 3 hours later. You said she was my type. You wanted this, right? Classic deflection. Then a day of silence. Followed by. She asked about you. I didn't reply. Not because I was mad. But because I was thinking. Because this wasn't going to be a clean triangle. This was going to be a goddamn war. And wars don't start with bombs. They start with silence. That evening, Abby was brushing her hair in my mirror, humming some soft melody that made my skin itch. She looked like something out of a Pinterest board, messy bun, oversized shirt, bare legs, innocence packaged in exhaustion. I watched her. Not just her body, but her eyes. The way they darted. Avoided mine. She knew I knew. But she didn't want to say it. And I wasn't going to make it easy for her. "You seem happy lately," I said, sipping my tea. She paused. Smiled without teeth. "Yeah, I guess I'm just adjusting." "To what?" I asked. She shrugged. "I don't know. Everything. Anyone." That landed. She blinked too fast. Shit. She was so fucking obvious. I smiled slowly, stood, walked over behind her. Slid my hands around her waist, my lips close to her ear. "You know you can tell me anything, right?" She nodded, breath catching. But she didn't say it. Didn't admit it. Didn't confess that Nate had invited her into his apartment again the night before. Didn't tell me he made her laugh in a way I never had. Didn't admit that her loyalty, her need for me, was cracking under the weight of new desire. But I already knew, because I'd watched it all. On the hallway cam, I saw her knock. I saw him open the door shirtless with that smug, try-hard smile. I saw her hesitate, then step inside, and not come out for over an hour. So I waited. Let her pretend. Let her soak in guilt. Let it ferment. People underestimate how exhausting secrets can be. How heavy they get. How they rot from the inside out. And Abby was soft, emotionally, mentally. She wasn't built for deception. She could barely carry her past, let alone a new lie. So I gave it time. Let her unravel. And while she unraveled, I dug deeper. Nate, for all his cocky posturing, was starting to slip. He texted less. Asked more questions. Tried to flip the dynamic. "Are you jealous? What are we even doing? Why do you want us to meet if it just pisses you off?" The audacity. I didn't respond for 2 days. Then finally, because I needed to see who breaks first. And it's not going to be me. He didn't reply after that. I knew he was brooding. Men like Nate don't know how to process being outplayed by a woman who's three moves ahead. He probably paced around his apartment, jerking off to the idea of regaining control. But control isn't a prize you earn back. It's a leash you never notice tightening. By the weekend, Abby broke. It was subtle. We were sitting on the balcony, her head in my lap, the city bleeding lights beneath us. She had a blanket wrapped around her like armor, but her shoulders were trembling beneath it. "I need to tell you something," she said, her voice cracking. I didn't flinch, didn't move, didn't breathe. Okay, I whispered, stroking her hair. She didn't look up. It's about Nate. There it was. I let silence answer her. Let her fill it. We've been talking. Not like, a lot, but enough. I didn't want to hide it from you. He's nice. And for once, I feel like someone looks at me without seeing all the fucked up parts. Her voice broke. I kept stroking her hair. Still no reaction. Still no anger. Because that's the thing, people expect confrontation. Drama. Accusations. But when you give them stillness, they drown in it. She waited for a slap that never came. Waited for me to scream. When I didn't, she started crying. I'm sorry, she whispered. I know, I said. And I kept stroking her hair. She fell asleep like that. Tears on my thigh. Guilt in her chest. Leash around her soul. That night, I stayed up watching the hallway footage. Every frame. Abby knocking. Nate opening the door. Their awkward, nervous smiles. The look they gave each other like teenagers trying to pretend they weren't horny. They didn't fuck. Yet. But the tension was there. Alive. Crawling between them like electricity in a flooded basement. And I realized something I hadn't expected. Something dangerous. I was jealous. Not because I loved either of them. I didn't. I'm not sure I can. But because they belonged to me. And now, they were orbiting each other. Breaking free. Creating something new. Something outside of my design. And that was unacceptable. So I did what I do best. I sowed seeds. That Monday, I sent Abby a message from a burner app. No ID. No name. Just. Nate tells every girl she's the only one. No punctuation. Anonymous enough to be haunting. Personal enough to ignite doubt. Then an hour later, I sent Nate this. She's not who she says she is. Check her ex's police records. Ask her why she cried when he left. Both of them spiraled by nightfall. Abby barely spoke over dinner. Nate paced his hallway like a ghost. And me? I sat in my apartment, sipping wine, listening to the new voicemails they were each too scared to send each other. Because chaos isn't just useful. It's a reminder. A reset button. A leash tightening after too much slack. By the time midnight rolled around, Abby was in bed with her back turned to me. Nate hadn't texted in hours. The building was quiet. But in that silence, I felt it, the shift. This wasn't just a game anymore. This was possession. Obsession. Mine. The strings were tightening. But so was something else. A crack. A pressure. Something inside me. Something I didn't recognize. Something that whispered. What happens when they pull back? What happens when they stop needing you? What happens when the bitch in apartment 9F gets outplayed? Chapter 7. The crown always cuts the queen. There's a moment, right before everything falls apart, when time slows. When you see it all in fragments, like broken glass reflecting pieces of the truth you refused to face. When every lie echoes back at you louder than your own heartbeat. When you realize, you didn't lose control, you gave it away. I used to believe I was untouchable. That from apartment 9F, I reigned over Parkview Towers like some unholy goddess, an architect of chaos. The silent bitch behind the curtain pulling every string while everyone else danced, begged, fucked, and wept at my command. But power isn't permanent. And control? Control is an illusion that disappears the moment someone stops being afraid of you. It started with a whisper. Not a sound. Not a voice. A feeling. A flicker of unease. That morning, I woke up alone. Abby had left the bed without kissing my shoulder like she always did. No post-it on the bathroom mirror. No coffee already brewed. No texts. No calls. Just silence. Which wouldn't have been alarming. If the night before, she hadn't cried in my arms about how safe she felt with me. If she hadn't looked up at me with those wounded eyes whispering, "Please don't ever leave me." But she had. And now she was gone. At first, I paced the apartment, checking the hallway feed. Nothing. 9B's door stayed shut. Lights off. No movement. I texted. Everything okay? No response. 5 minutes passed. Then 10. Then 20. So I knocked. She didn't answer. But someone else did. From down the hall. Nate. He stepped out of 9E, shirtless, hair tousled, like he didn't know what century he was in. We locked eyes. Something about his face had changed. Harder. Colder. Smarter. I stepped toward him. You've seen Abby? Yeah, he said flatly. She's with me. I blinked. Excuse me? Since when? Since she stopped pretending you weren't poisoning her. The silence hit like a gunshot. I stared at him, searching for a crack, a lie, a smirk. anything to prove he was bluffing. But he wasn't. He was calm, centered, the kind of calm that comes after the storm. "She found the cameras," he said. "Your little peephole project. Your feed." He held up a phone. "My feed. My fucking hallway footage." Playing on his screen. I felt the blood drain from my face. "She showed me," he continued. "Then we started digging. Kevin helped. You remember Kevin, right? You made him think you owned him. Kevin? The sock-wearing tax fraud with a humiliation fetish? He was helping them. Oh, and Abby?" Nate said, stepping closer. "She found the recordings. Of her. Her therapy sessions. Her crying in your arms. You recorded every second. What the fuck is wrong with you?" I couldn't breathe. I wanted to scream. To strike him. To twist his pretty little face into a bloody pulp. But I didn't. Because just behind him, Abby appeared. And she looked like a different person. Her posture was straighter. Her expression calm. Her lips pressed into a line like she'd tasted rage and decided to drink the whole fucking bottle. "You lied to me," she said, voice hollow. I didn't answer. "You made me think you loved me." "I did," I whispered. "No," she said. "You loved owning me." She stepped forward, holding something. A USB stick. "I copied everything," she said. "All your files. Every video. Every note. Every message you sent pretending to be anonymous. Every manipulation." "You don't understand," I snapped. "I was protecting you." She laughed. A dry, sharp sound that cracked the space between us like thunder. "You were feeding on me. I gave you a reason to exist." I screamed. "I gave you safety. I gave you power. I made you feel like someone gave a fuck. You made me a prisoner." Her voice didn't shake. "Mine did. You don't get to call it love just because I let you use me," she said. I turned to Nate. "You don't even like her," I hissed. "You like the drama. The power shift. You like feeling like the good guy for once." Nate stepped in close. His breath hit my cheek. "You're right," he whispered. "But even the good guy knows when to bury the monster." They left me standing there. Alone. Stripped. Unraveled. And I stood there for hours. Literally hours. Watching the hallway loop on my laptop like it was a funeral slideshow. I watched myself fall apart. Over and over again. And when I finally moved, it wasn't to cry. It was to burn. The storage unit was still there. Unbothered. All my files. My corkboards. My plans. My kingdom. I poured lighter fluid across the floor. Soaked the carpet, the desk, the chair. My journals. My recordings. Everything. Then I lit the match. It crackled like applause. The fire spread fast. I didn't run. I watched it for 6 minutes and 42 seconds before the alarm blared, and I finally walked away. I didn't look back. Because I knew. That chapter was over. Now I sit in a different building. A cheaper one. New city. New name. No cameras. No files. No puppets. But every night, I stare through the slats of my blinds at the apartment across from mine. A young couple lives there. They fight a lot. The guy leaves late. The girl cries on the couch. Sometimes, she stares into space like she's wondering what it would feel like to burn it all down. I haven't done anything. Haven't said anything. Yet. But I can feel it again. That itch. That urge. To pull one string. To send one note. To find one weakness. Because here's the truth. You can kill the queen. You can burn the throne. But the bitch in apartment 9F? She doesn't die. She relocates.